Today on The World...
Does this House want to deliver Brexit?
You guys were supposed to say yes. That was Theresa May. She's had to postpone a key Brexit vote today. We'll hear more about that later. Meanwhile...
Le gouvernement utilise la machine répressive.
Macron faces down the yellow vest riots sweeping France. Plus...
This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
No, Eleanor Roosevelt is not on the show. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is. It turns 70 today. Those stories on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you here. When a president decides to address the nation in primetime, it usually means something pretty serious is going down. That's the case in France today, where President Emmanuel Macron went live on national television at 8 p.m. local time.
Mon seul souci, c'est vous. Mon seul combat, c'est pour vous.
My only concern is you, said Macron. Our only battle is for France. The French president was responding to 4 weeks of unrest across France by les gilets jaunes, the yellow vests. What began as a protest over a gas tax has clearly turned into something much larger. Sophie Petter is Paris bureau chief for The Economist. What was Macron trying to accomplish with this speech, and how well did he do?
Well, I think he had two objectives. One of them was to announce a series of measures that were going to help those struggling on low incomes with some tax credits, some cancelled payroll charges, and general sort of income support measures for those both on low incomes and the retired on small pensions. But I think, you know, there was a much bigger and more important message this evening, and that was that he recognized, President Macron, that some of the things he said have wounded people, that some of the comments he's made has made given people the impression he doesn't care, and that he said, you know, I do, and I'm sorry. And this, I think, must have taken a lot of courage for him to do, but it was incredibly important because one of the things behind this protest over the last few weeks has been a feeling, a very common feeling on the ground in France, that they have a president who doesn't care, who's completely indifferent to their needs, and that needed to be corrected. And I think with that message, he will have gone some way to correcting that impression.
I mean, he's faced a lot of criticism. There are these memes like, let them drive electric cars instead of eat cake. How did he look? What was his tone?
He was looking very serious, very solemn. It was the right sort of tone, I think. He's not a politician who does a sort of folksy thing. He, even during the campaign last year, he doesn't naturally tell anecdotes on the campaign trail. He doesn't speak from the heart. He's really a rationalist. He's an intellectual. He's a philosophy graduate. You know, this is the sort of person he is. So it doesn't do it easily, starting to, you know, trying to kind of speak from the heart. And I wouldn't say he really managed that, but the important thing was that he found the words. He found the words to say, I'm sorry if I wounded people. And that matters hugely, because one of the things I found when I've been talking to people who've been protesting, they're across France, but the people I've spoken to myself have said, you know, what really upsets us is that we have the feeling that he doesn't respect us, that he sort of looks down on us from his palace, in Republican France. And that people found that just intolerable. So I think those words were really important.
Sophie, this anger over diminishing economic prospects for many French families, do you see a correlation with the kind of anger we've seen here in the U.S.?
I think so. I think it's part of a phenomenon that is really not unique to France by any means. I think you see it in the U.S., you see it in the U.K. with Brexit. It's part of the explanation behind the Brexit vote. I think it's part of, you know, our sort of post-industrial societies, the changing nature of the workplace, changing forces, economic forces due to globalization and technological change. All of those things are hitting all of our countries and all of our economies. And it's the sort of squeezed middle that is finding it the hardest to adapt, wage stagnation, and a sense that things are not, you know, the prospects are just not what they were, certainly for many of those people, but also for their children. So it is a very common form of anger. And in some respects, I think, you know, we shouldn't be surprised to see it in France, because if you remember last year, Emmanuel Macron was elected president, but he came out, he was facing in the runoff at the presidential election Marine Le Pen off the far-right National Front.
Right.
And her the fact that she got to the second round runoff at all reflects that same anger. So I think we are looking at something. There's a specific form of disappointment or frustration with Emmanuel Macron, but there's also a much more generalized sense of, you know, trying to find a place at a difficult economic time in the West.
Sophie Peder, Paris bureau chief for The Economist, also the author of a new book, Révolution Française, Emmanuel Macron and the Quest to Reinvent a Nation. Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
Macron wasn't the only world leader who's had to backtrack on a key issue lately. Take a listen to this. British Prime Minister Theresa May today addressing Parliament.
I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it.
British lawmakers reacting to May's announcement that she was postponing a key vote in Parliament on Brexit. So first question for my BBC colleague Rob Watson in London. Was this what he expected when he woke up this morning?
I thought there was a chance, but I don't think there's any doubt that the British government is in danger of looking like it's gone from being in chaos to being in a state of farce, because the Prime Minister and her government have just really stretched their credibility and authority to breaking point, because up until this dramatic change around, we were told 100% this vote is going ahead. It's the best deal that Britain could have got for the European Union. It's either this deal or no deal or no Brexit. So to make this turnaround is, I think the only word you could use for it is humiliating.
I really want us to try and understand what this moment means for the Brexit negotiations. Just remind us what today's vote was all about.
Well, I think what it means for the Brexit negotiations is something that people around the world are going to be familiar with, and that is that Theresa May has again kicked the can down the road. Now, every time she does that, the road is getting a bit shorter. But it seems to me that the problem she faces just won't go away, no matter how far she kicks the can down the road or how many times. And that is that Britain's politicians still cannot agree 2.5 years after the vote what to do about the Brexit referendum in 2016. Because what should have happened this week was that Parliament would have voted on a plan by Theresa May for carrying out the results of the referendum. And she could see she was going to lose that vote. So instead, what she played for, more delay.
So that's what today's vote was about, delaying the vote again.
There has been no vote, Marco. I mean, that in a way is what she's done. She's decided to duck the vote. And again, one really has to go back to basics, because a lot of people are probably looking at this thinking, hang on a minute, British Parliament looks pretty crazy. British politics looks pretty crazy. It is crazy, but it boils down to these very simple things. And that is, in the referendum, the majority of Brits voted for something that the majority of politicians think is a really crazy idea, leaving the European Union. And despite many attempts by Theresa May to try and figure a way of doing it, there is still no consensus among Britain's politicians about how, or indeed among some of them, whether to do Brexit.
The trip-up issue appears to be the backstop. And I'm saying that like I know what I'm talking about. Remind us what the backstop is.
So, right.
And why is it proving to be such a stumbling block?
I mean, who would have thought, Marco, that this would become a term? I should say that my elderly 80-odd-year-old mother asked me the other day what the backstop was, and I happened to be on a train. She called me on my cell phone to ask me, and the whole carriage started listening to me. So the best I could do for my mum and for those listening on this crazy train with everyone looking at me like I was a crazy guy.
Yeah, tell us what you told them.
So it's essentially that the idea is Britain leaves the European Union next March, and built into the withdrawal agreement is this idea of a transition. So we sort of stay in the EU until the end of 2020. In that time, we're supposed to negotiate our new relationship with the European Union. And the idea is that it'll be so close, so great, that there'll be no issue of having to have a border in Ireland between the North and the Republic. But it was felt, just in case Britain couldn't negotiate such a deal, there needs to be an insurance policy, a backstop, as it's become called. And that backstop is the idea that all of Britain stays in a customs union with the EU to avoid the hard border.
What are Theresa May's options then today?
Well, we know what her plan is, and that is to go back to the European Union and presumably get some cosmetic changes. I don't think anyone expects anything more than that. And then basically to hope that the clock does it, that MPs will be sweating that she brings this back much, much later on, maybe after Christmas and New Year. Who knows?
Rob Watson, the BBC's UK correspondent, speaking with us from Westminster. Thanks very much, Rob.
Thanks, Marco. Good to be with you.
Over in the UK, some people who voted for Brexit now feel disappointed, to put it mildly, because of all the complications. You might say the same for many people here in the US who were sold on the promise that overseas jobs would come back to America under President Trump. Instead, we have a trade war with China and companies like General Motors announcing massive layoffs. My BBC colleague Aline McBull went to Ohio to hear how people there are feeling about that.
It was a gut punch. It was just hard to breathe, and everyone just kind of looked around at each other just in shock.
Casey King has worked at the car assembly plant in Lordstown, Ohio for more than 23 years. It's a massive factory taking up more than 900 acres. But General Motors, once America's biggest employer, has announced that from March, no vehicles will be produced there.
It's almost like you're experiencing a death. You know, it's just hard to imagine that the one thing you thought you would never hear and never wanted to hear just happened.
With some cuts to the workforce in recent years, Casey and many others had considered selling their homes and moving elsewhere.
Let me tell you folks in Ohio.
Last year, though, visiting here, President Trump promised this.
Don't sell your house. Don't sell your house. Do not sell it. We're going to get those values up. We're going to get those jobs coming back. And we're going to fill up those factories or rip them down and build brand new ones. So it's going to happen.
He went around promising anyone anything just to get what he wanted. And I've heard people compare him to a snake oil salesman. He's just, going around and selling false hope. And he needs to realize that people are actually believing him and expecting him to do these things.
Casey herself never voted for Donald Trump, but says many of her co-workers were swayed by his promises, and she says still believe he might deliver on them.
I had this conversation with someone the other day. They said, I know you don't like him. And I said, no, I don't. And they said, I don't like him either, but we need his help.
But General Motors says it's just restructuring, and that's not Donald Trump's fault. In another huge industry in the state, though, it's a different story. We travel to the other side of Ohio, where agriculture has been devastated because exports to China have plummeted.
A decision was made by our government that we had nothing to do with that caused that devastating drop.
Alan Armstrong's family has been growing soya beans in Ohio for generations, but Donald Trump's economic sparring with China, introducing tariffs on Chinese goods that led to a counteraction by Beijing, has made for the most difficult of years.
60% of all the soybeans we raised have been exported over the last 5 years to China. And when the trade dispute / trade war started, effectively those sales went to zero. And so, you know, we have built this market with our own dollars, personal dollars invested to build it. And to see it disrupted so quickly is very disheartening.
But in recent days, the president's been making more promises that China will start buying U.S. agricultural products again, including soybeans.
This is the first good news we've heard on this front since July.
And in spite of facing so many problems because of the trade war, Alan, who voted for Donald Trump, is sticking by him.
I don't remember in my lifetime a president of the United States talking about agriculture as often as I've heard Donald Trump speak about ag. So it's good to have our profile raised. Okay.
So you don't hear people saying in the community, you know, I voted for the guy, now look what's happened, I regret that.
Yeah, no. You don't hear that. You hear, gosh, I hope he knows what he's doing.
Speaking personally for a moment, having traveled throughout this country over the past 2 years, the notion that there are huge droves of people who did and now wish they hadn't voted for Donald Trump has just not been borne out by anything I've experienced. And that's even when, as in this case, it appears those people have lost out because of his actions.
The BBC's Aline McBull reporting there from Ohio. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
We will never surrender America's sovereignty to an unelected, unaccountable global bureaucracy.
President Trump speaking at the United Nations in September. He was referring there to the International Criminal Court, the body that prosecutes crimes against humanity. The notion that all human beings share the same basic rights was originally laid out in an agreement that marks a big anniversary today. The world's Rupa Shenoy has more.
70 years ago, world leaders were still reeling from war.
When they saw the German concentration camps, men toughened by combat were sickened by the sights and smells and the cruelties that had been committed.
Leaders were haunted by previously unthinkable atrocities. In 1948, they gathered in Paris. Contributors from Australia, Canada, Chile, China, France, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom drafted the first international agreement on human rights. Former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt spoke for the U.S.
This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
48 countries signed the non-binding Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It became part of the foundation of the UN, the first step toward building binding international human rights treaties and humanitarian work around the world. Work that Ravina Shamdasani says still doesn't get a lot of attention. She's with the UN Human Rights Office.
It's very easy when you're reading the headlines to fall into despair and to think that it's all unraveling, but really it's not.
For example, Shamdasani says she was in South India helping set up camps for displaced people after a tsunami. She saw a sign that told people they each had a right to one bag of rice a week, because under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone is entitled to a standard of living adequate for health.
And that, to me, really said a lot. It said to me that you may have lost your homes and you may have lost your livelihood, but you have not lost your human rights and your dignity. And you can go with your chest out, your head held up high, and demand that bag of rice.
But there were always critics who worried the declaration and the UN would interfere with domestic law. Ona Hathaway is founder and director of the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School.
Actually, early on, interestingly, in the United States, one of the real challenges was concern that human rights treaties would require doing something about Jim Crow laws in the South.
It was a tension within U.S. politics from the start. Would America submit to international justice? It's still a tension now. Most recently, the U.S. concern has been a potential investigation in Afghanistan. The International Criminal Court's prosecutor asked to investigate the situation there, including U.S. actions. Hathaway believes Trump's rejection of the court undermines the UN's foundation.
I think that what you're seeing in the Trump administration right now is a real unwillingness to publicly, at least, strongly support the principles behind the Universal Declaration.
Hathaway says that's led to human rights abuses around the world by leaders who no longer worry about consequences. Brett Schaefer disagrees. He's with the Heritage Foundation, and he says the U.S. still champions human rights.
I think that the administration is criticizing the U.N. in particular ways. I don't think that the United States is criticizing the U.N. for the Universal Declaration.
Schaefer says the real problem is that the U.N. has represented itself as the guardian of human rights.
A lot of times people will look at the deficit of human rights around the world and kick the can over and saying, well, let the U.N. deal with it. But the U.N. is not able to advance the ball in a lot of areas.
He says the U.N. doesn't enforce the declaration. Instead, it allows participation by countries that flout human rights. And Schaefer says those misbehaving states have used the U.N. to deflect criticism of their countries and heap it on others.
And so when you have a majority of member states in the UN that do not adhere to fundamental human rights and freedoms, it's hardly surprising that the organization itself has failed so miserably to champion those rights over the years.
Last month, one of the staunch supporters of the UN acknowledged that criticism.
Ich frage mich oft.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is a strong supporter of human rights and leader of the very country whose former leaders ordered the Holocaust, which brought about the declaration. At the Paris Peace Forum, she warned that institutions like the UN can easily be destroyed. Building them up again is incredibly difficult.
Zerstören kann man Institutionen schnell wieder aufbauen, ist unglaublich schwierig.
Merkel said she often wonders if world leaders could build that foundation again. Would they adopt a Universal Declaration of Human Rights if they were asked to today? She fears they wouldn't. And her message to the international community was this: don't forget the lessons of history. For the world, Rupa Shenoy.
The preamble of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights makes the point that among the freedoms guaranteed to all human beings is the freedom from fear. Right now, the people of Yemen don't have that freedom. They're living in fear of a war that's been going on for almost 4 years now. Last week, the UN did manage to get the main warring parties to gather in Sweden to talk. The World's Stephen Snyder follows Yemen for us, and he's here to tell us what these talks are about.
Well, the Yemen war has been going on for 4 years. Between 10 and 40,000 people have died in the fighting. On top of that, the economy is a mess. Food and medicine can't get into the country. And the result of that is that 1 million people got cholera last year, and 2 million people are getting one meal a day or less. I saw a video of some people eating grass.
So these talks in Sweden, how are they going?
Well, much better than people thought. The UN not only got the two warring sides, the major sides, to get together to talk, but it was for the first time in 2 years they got them to agree to swap prisoners. We asked Hisham El Omeisi about it on Friday. Mm. You remember, you were talking with him. He said something that Yemenis keep telling me: don't get too excited about this.
We need to curb our enthusiasm. We need to set low expectations. They're not peace talks. They're political consultations. They're basically trying to draw a framework to resume the peace talks.
Hisham, as you know, was a prisoner of the group that controls the Yemeni capital.
The Houthis.
Yeah, and they're finally talking with the Yemeni government that's in exile, the old Yemeni government that wants to be in power again.
And that's a side that Saudi Arabia is backing.
Yes, with support from the U.S. So the Saudis are at the talks. The U.S. is watching it very closely.
So what good could come of these talks?
Confidence-building measures. Martin Griffiths, he's the UN envoy, he says that he has a plan for a diplomatic settlement for the next round of talks.
Yeah, so that seems like it's a good start.
But while people are very optimistic in Sweden, people in Yemen are still pretty divided, like this woman that I talked to today.
I live in Sana'a. I live under the Houthis' control. Yeah, like everything is upside down.
She's a middle-class Yemeni. She's not starving. She doesn't have cholera. But her life is totally ruined, and it's because of Houthi control, according to her.
Most of the people up here, they're struggling to have a normal life, to have water and fuel and food on the table.
So she's one of the lucky Yemenis. She has Wi-Fi, she has a job, but she's the exception. She said that until the fighting stops, and there's fighting going on right now, today, until the fighting stops, conditions are just going to get worse.
That's the World's Stephen Snyder has been telling me about progress, small progress, with the war in Yemen. Thanks very much, Stephen.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Congress has a plan to stop pests from outside the U.S. from coming into the country and damaging trees.
They're looking for a bug inside a board in a pallet in the bottom of a shipping container.
Plus, Elvis stops traffic in Germany, literally. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is a big global climate summit going on this week in Poland. And yes, the U.S. is there, but the reception from others at the summit to what the U.S. is saying there, listen to this.
It is clear that energy innovation and fossil fuels will continue to play a leading role.
That was White House climate advisor Wells Griffith touting the continued use of fossil fuels at an official U.S. event today at the summit in Katowice. His comments, as you started to hear there, got some pushback.
We hold a solution, and we know that we must keep it in the ground. I said keep it in the ground. Keep it in the ground.
We hold the solutions, and we must keep it in the ground. Go the chanters. Reporter Rachel Waldholtz is in Katowice and covering the climate summit for us. You were at this event today, Rachel. What happened next?
Well, the protesters walked out, and there were a couple dozen of them. So by the time they left, it was pretty clear that most of the people at the event were either protesters or reporters. But the event continued, and they stuck to the U.S. line at this conference, which is that the U.S. is planning to pull out of the Paris Agreement as soon as they can. And the line is that President Trump won't stay in an agreement that threatens U.S. economic growth or national security. In their view, the Paris Agreement does both. Of course, lots of people disagree, and recent reports from the U.S. government say that there are economic costs and national security threats if we don't cut carbon emissions. But the panelists insisted that the U.S. can continue to burn fossil fuels in a way that also cuts emissions.
So that outburst in front of the White House climate advisor there in Poland, I mean, does that suggest there's a lot of frustration with the U.S.?
Yes, and not just for this particular event. On Saturday, the U.S. joined forces with Russia, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia to block an attempt to welcome a new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So that report, which got a lot of attention this fall, said that basically the world needs to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, or we're going to face more catastrophic effects than we thought. And the report was actually commissioned by the climate conference. It was agreed to by all the countries in order for it to be released. But the U.S. refused to ratify language saying that the conference here welcomes that report. Really, what they were arguing over was, do we need to limit warming to 1.5 degrees? And the U.S. was essentially saying, we don't want that to be the centerpiece of how we attack this problem.
Let's zoom out for a minute here, Rachel. What is at stake at this meeting? Because we've had that big breakthrough agreement in Paris 3 years ago. Since then, Trump has been elected, not to mention an almost daily litany of news and scientific reports pointing to how severe and urgent this problem is. So why is this meeting so important?
Yeah, so folks are expecting this meeting to be pretty much the most important climate gathering since the Paris Agreement. And that's because this agreement is supposed to come out with the rules to put the Paris Agreement into action. So the Paris Agreement was sort of the big principles, like the world agrees to cut emissions. And this is the nitty-gritty of what does that look like? And the second thing is essentially they're used as moments of peer pressure for countries to push each other to up their commitments and to be more ambitious than they've been in the past.
I like the way you put that. So, I mean, peer pressure often has negative consequences. How is all that going?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the interesting thing about these conferences is that no country has leverage to force any other country to do anything. So it's really about naming and shaming. And I would say at this conference, the U.S. is getting called out quite a bit.
So what's ahead, Rachel?
Well, so this is the second week of the conference, and the big sticking points right now are money. That's always a big one. So developing countries really want assurances that they're going to get a certain amount of money to deal with the impacts of climate change. And then the other big question is, you know, do developing countries have to live up to the same reporting requirements as developed countries?
And how are the developing countries feeling about that? Because I imagine a lot of them would say that's not fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these questions have gotten harder with the U.S. pulling out of the agreement. You know, the U.S. is the second largest emitter after China. It's the largest cumulative emitter over time. And so it's a lot harder to argue for these points when the U.S. is, you know, ostensibly walking out the door.
Rachel, we were talking earlier on the show about the yellow vest protests in France, which actually started with people upset about it. Tax on gasoline and a lot about climate change, but it's since evolved into protests about economic hardship for middle and working class people. Is that discussion about how to fix climate change and who bears the burden, is that being discussed in Poland?
Yeah, I would say that that question is really the backdrop to this conference. And in fact, the Polish presidency has made the idea of a just transition, that's what they call it, a centerpiece of this conference. And I mean, it's the backdrop in a really literal way. We're in Katowice, Poland, which is the heart of Polish coal country. And the question of, you know, how do you make sure that communities that rely on fossil fuels aren't left behind as the world moves towards a low carbon future is certainly a big question hanging over this conference.
Reporter Rachel Waldholtz at the UN Climate Conference in Katowice, Poland. Rachel, we'll be checking back in with you later this week. Thanks very much for today.
Great. Thanks, Marco.
Meanwhile, back in Washington, it's crunch time. The current Congress has just a few weeks left in office before Democrats take control of the House. So lawmakers are scrambling to tie up loose ends, like the 2018 Farm Bill. Buried in that massive piece of legislation, a plan to strengthen how the government intercepts foreign pests. This is about insects from other parts of the world and how they end up here, causing billions of dollars in damage each year. The World's Jason Margolis begins our story in Millbrook, New York, a village 2 hours north of New York City.
From a distance, the hemlock trees by a creek look just fine to me. But forest ecologist Gary Lovett knows better.
You can see on the underside of these twigs, there are white, fluffy balls.
That fluff is the protective coatings for the hemlock woolly adelgid, a tiny insect from East Asia.
And, of course, one of them, they're very tiny, so one of them won't bother the tree, but when we have millions and millions of them on a tree, it eventually kills the tree.
The hemlock woolly adelgid is slowly killing trees from Maine to Georgia. It's among the latest in a line of foreign pests hitchhiking to the United States.
Okay, this is a wooden pallet that's used to ship things around the world.
This basic technology, the wooden pallet that can be scooped up with a forklift, revolutionized international shipping back in World War II. Problem is, pests can burrow into the wood. Pests can also hide on foreign plants. So Congress added an amendment in this year's Farm Bill to try and prevent this.
I would categorize this as a small step forward, but it's the first step forward. So
Lovett, who is with the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies and offered guidance for the amendment, offered tepid praise for it because it got watered down. There's nothing in it about wooden pallets now. It's a $12 billion American business, and the industry didn't want more regulation. The National Wooden Pallet and Container Association President Brent McClendon says international rules were already established a dozen years ago. Shipping pallets are now either treated with heat or fumigated.
Well, I believe in the system. I know that it is effective, and I know that the compliance rates are really high, and I know that our governments, all of our governments, both here in the U.S. and abroad, work very hard to have comprehensive inspections at the perimeter and really protect against invasive species.
Still, each year, some 13 million containers stacked high with wooden pallets are shipped to the U.S. And forest ecologist Gary Lovett says inspectors can't possibly ensure all of those are clean.
You can imagine they're looking for a bug inside a board in a pallet. In the bottom of a shipping container in a ship.
All it takes is a few bad pallets. So Lovett argues for ditching wood and replacing them with other materials, like recycled plastic. Right now, according to some studies, invasive pests are costing the U.S. economy close to $5 billion a year. Trees don't just die in forests. They're in cities and our yards.
Most of the cost is being borne by homeowners and by local governments, municipalities.
And you see the yellow dots. Well, all the dots, of course, are ash trees. The red ones are...
Mark Nelson shows me a map of the ash trees owned by the city of nearby Poughkeepsie, New York. He's the city administrator here. The map has 300 color-coded dots. Red and yellow ones mean another foreign pest, the emerald ash borer, has found a new home.
It's safe to say that of the city-owned trees, 90% are infected.
Take them down, or eventually they die and fall. You can imagine the horror story lawsuits there. So the city recently took down 50 ash trees. The cost, $82,000. That might not sound like much, but for a small city with a big deficit, Nelson says it's a lot. Trees also improve property values, air quality, and provide shade. They matter a lot to a city. And multiply Poughkeepsie's problem across thousands of communities like it?
Can municipalities fight this fight? And the answer is clearly no.
Because by the time a pest is already here...
It's kind of too late. We dump a lot of resources in trying to control things that should have been prevented in the first place.
Kerry Van Camp manages nearby Vassar College's 500-acre ecological preserve.
I'm glad I put on these boots.
Yeah.
We go on the muddiest, goopiest hike of my life and eventually get to a strand of dying ash trees. Van Camp is experimenting with breeding more pest-resistant trees as well as biocontrols, like importing a wasp native to Asia.
It's a stingless wasp, so you don't have to worry. It lays its egg inside the emerald ash borer egg, and the larva of the wasp essentially eats inside of the eggs.
Amazing. A couple of problems, though. The wasp is only partly effective, and releasing foreign wasps on a large scale would be too expensive, and it could raise new problems. So eventually, many of the ash trees will die and new species will take their place. Van Camp says there's nothing wrong with change. Plant and tree species have always migrated, and humans have helped with that, intentionally or not. Problem is, today, we're moving things at an alarming rate.
Someone described it to me once as like a snow globe. All the species are the little flakes in that, and humans have most recently just shook it up, and all that snow is flying, and species are landing all over the place, and it's creating these kind of interactions that we don't know what the response is going to be.
And the whole ecosystem here, the animals, the birds, the fish, the soil, it's built around native trees. Back by the stream in Millbrook, Gary Lovett says the only way to protect our forest and urban canopies is for politicians to get tough, to prevent pests from arriving here in the first place.
I'm not much of a politician, but, you know, this is a situation where we're getting a raw deal on trade. Our trading partners are not only, we have a balance of payments problem, but they're also sending us nasty bugs along with it.
That's a trade deficit he'd love to hear talked about in Washington. For The World, Jason Margolis, Millbrook, New York.
Elvis Presley is back in Friedberg, Germany. I know, let me explain. Elvis was actually stationed in Friedberg, this German town, during a stint in the U.S. Army between 1958 and 1960. People in Friedberg still like to remember that. So the town decided, why not? Let's put Elvis's image on the traffic lights. I asked local politician Marion Goetz to explain. She was accompanied by professional interpreter Sabina Hartmann.
Elvis Presley hat eine sehr große Fangemeinde in Friedberg, in Deutschland und der ganzen Welt.
Elvis Presley, of course, has a huge fan community in Friedberg, in Germany and worldwide. And annually, we have our big Elvis Festival, the Elvis Weekend, on the 16th of August to commemorate his death. A local paper once wrote a satirical comment and said, why don't we have Elvis's silhouette on the red lights? I saw it and I thought, great idea. Why don't we implement it and offer a further attraction to all the Elvis fans who come and visit Friedberg from all over the world? Other German cities have already come up with red lights featuring local celebrities. So I thought, why shouldn't we do it here? On the 1st of July, I became the vice mayor of the city of Friedberg, and I'm responsible for administration and also the red lights, of course. So I had to motivate my team and implement this great idea.
I mean, it is a pretty sophisticated set of lights. It's unmistakably Elvis. It's that classic pose of him in front of the mic stand in red. The green one is that classic pose of him on his tiptoes shaking his hips. How many lights did you have to change for this, and what was the total cost?
Insgesamt wurden drei Ampeln verändert, also sechs Ampeln.
So we changed three red lights, that means six stations in total, and it cost us a total of almost 900 euros.
So it wasn't like you changed all the pedestrian lights in the city. I mean, clearly you've got a lot of love for Elvis there in Friedberg. What's been the reaction?
The reaction in Friedberg was überwältigend, aber nicht nur in Friedberg, sondern
so the reaction was overwhelming for these traffic lights at Elvis Presley Square here in Friedberg. We got congratulations, letters and phone calls, first from Germany, Europe, and then from around the globe since last Tuesday, since the traffic lights were installed. Great response for such a small measure. The traditional Friedberg Christmas market opened last weekend and visitors came, they took selfies. Some families just waited for the traffic lights to change to have the picture of the red Elvis and the green Elvis for their family album. So overwhelming response.
So you've got the square, you've got the lights, you've got the European Elvis Festival just down the road. Are there still people in Friedberg who remember when Elvis was alive and living there?
Yes, there are many people who still remember Elvis Presley, who were delighted when the TV interviewers came. Many people remember Elvis Presley from back when they were young people, teenagers. They loved his music back then. They still love his music and they're still big fans, and they just had a little pilgrimage to the traffic lights.
How long are these Elvis pedestrian traffic lights going to stay up?
Forever.
Yeah.
Marianne Goetz, thank you very much. Dankeschön.
Thank you very much for your interest.
And I forgot to thank the interpreter. That was Sabina Hartmann. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Angela Merkel is still Germany's chancellor and will be for some time, but Merkel's 18-year run as the leader of Germany's most powerful political party, that is now officially over. The Christian Democratic Union, or CDU, chose its new leader last week. Her name is Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer.
The name is a tongue twister for Germans as well, which is why pretty much everybody has gotten used to saying AKK, or in English, AKK.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is with the Brookings Institution. We called her up today to find out who AKK is.
She is a genuinely interesting development in German politics. She was the minister president of a small Western German state, the state of Saar, which is a little bit like Pennsylvania, only I think smaller. In other words, it's a formerly heavily industrialized, dependent on coal and steel, hit hard by the transition into renewables and out of mining, and having to reinvent itself in all sorts of ways.
What does that tell us about Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer if she comes from this part of the country that seems to have been, as you say, kind of like Pennsylvania, forgotten and probably suffered economically? I mean, does she kind of represent populist views?
No, she doesn't represent populist views. But I think she understands the kind of economic and social grievances that have caused populism to some degree.
Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer has been dubbed the mini Merkel by German media. How are they alike and how are they different?
AKK has said herself that she doesn't like this label because it's obviously condescending. That said, it's generally known that she was Merkel's preferred succession candidate. And just by way of a footnote, let's say here that Merkel is the first chancellor in my lifetime to have even attempted to line up her own succession. Most of her predecessors didn't try to do that. So how are they alike? She, AKK, is a centrist. She believes that Merkel's course over the last 18 years as party head of modernizing the CDU by moving it into the middle of the political spectrum. For American hearers, this is much like the triangulation that Bill Clinton undertook with the Democratic Party in the 90s, moving it more into the political middle and away from the left, except that here she's moving it away from the hard right. And AKK believes in this. The difference between AKK and Merkel is that AKK has positioned herself as more of a social conservative. She, for example, has expressed criticism of gay marriage. She's a practicing Catholic, she says, and she wants to have the union between men and women privileged over same-sex unions. She has also been critical of efforts to liberalize abortion by allowing abortion facilities to advertise their services more publicly, which currently is not allowed under German criminal law.
So more of a social conservative than Merkel, for sure.
Yes.
Now, a lot of Angela Merkel's recent fortunes have been defined by her acceptance of over 1 million immigrants in Germany a few years ago, as well as slowing that acceptance down after pushback from many Germans on the right. What is Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer's position on immigration?
Kramp-Karrenbauer has made it clear that she agrees with Merkel that at the time, in 2015, this was a necessary humanitarian gesture, and that to have done otherwise would have also created huge problems for our neighboring countries. But she has also criticized the lack of an adequate and fast response to resolving the multiple problems created thereby. She's made it very clear that she would crack down on illegal migration, and that she thinks that migrants who have tangled with the law ought to be deported more quickly.
Constanze, just one last thing. I was really struck earlier when you said that AKK's rise to the head of Merkel's party, the CDU, is a genuinely interesting development. Does that suggest that most political developments you see, like in the live feed from the German parliament, they're kind of ho-hum interesting?
No. I mean, look, I'm a political junkie, presumably like you are, so I find all of that interesting. But, this is the first time in Germany that a woman has followed a woman at the head of a major German party. That's a big deal.
Constanze Seltzenmuller of the Brookings Institution. Good to have you with us again. Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
Finally today, it is Monday, or as we've been calling it around here, Mood Music Monday. So here's a bright moment, as jazzman Rahsaan Roland Kirk used to refer to his love of music. Call this Mood Music Monday request an exceptionally bright moment. The tune is Brighter by Latin soul man Ozzo Motley. Some say we're heading for oblivion. Shine on the moon. Falling backwards down the rabbit hole. Today's request comes from Mikkel Weiser in Phoenix, Arizona, who listens to us on station KJZZ. Mikkel credits public radio for his discovery of Ozzo Motley in the first place. As to why he wants to hear this song, Brighter, I am apprehensive for my country, but the beat and message of it are infectious, he says. Mikkel tells us that he used to be a school teacher before going into politics. My most important lesson was carrying on, he says. Yep, Ozzo Motley is here to give us hope on this Monday so we can all carry on. Writer from Ozzo Motley, this Monday's Mood Music Request from Mikkel Weiser in Phoenix, Arizona. What is your mood? What is your music? The request lines are open. We're at PRI The World on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Marco Werman on both platforms as well. Let us know what song you want to hear. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.